just going to press.
Okay, yeah, so all the work that I'll be presenting today has been done in collaboration with a number of people, especially Tom Reader and Francis Gilbert down at Biology. And the talk's changed slightly from what was publicised. I'll be presenting two separate bits of work today. And so I'll begin by introducing species distribution models as a tool, and then talk about their uses that we've put them to, predicting species richness patterns and looking at the effects of climate change on species distributions. So species distribution models take a set of sightings, set of records of a species occurrence. So for example, this map on the left here shows a set of sightings for the marmalade fly in Britain. And they relate these sightings to a set of environmental variables. In the middle there, the sighting's been overlaid on a map of rainfall, but you can use all sorts of different variables describing climate, temperature, rainfall, habitat, soils, and anything you can get your hands on, really, that might affect species distributions. And then the model relates these two and builds a picture of where the kind of conditions that the species lives in over a broad area and comes up with a predicted distribution for your whole study area of interest, and that's shown on the right there. So green and yellow areas indicate places where the species is less likely to occur, orange and red areas where it's more likely to occur. And so there are a number of applications that species distribution models have been used for: identifying diversity hotspots, evaluating protected areas, finding new populations of rare species, identifying sites for reintroductions, and predicting impacts of climate change. So there have been a number of studies investigating correlates of species richness all over the world. One group that's done a lot of work is based in Finland and have published a number of studies on patterns of butterfly species richness. But there have been very few attempts to use species distribution models to try and estimate species richness. One notable exception is a paper by Garcia, who looked at Mexican richness patterns of Mexican reptiles and amphibians. But there have, to date, been no explicit comparisons of the more traditional approaches to predicting species richness with estimates using species distribution models. And so we approached this problem using data on Egyptian mammals and butterflies. Egypt has a very interesting fauna. There are two endemic and two near endemic species of butterflies. On the right there is the Sinai baton blue, which is also the smallest butterfly in the world. And that's an endemic to Egypt. And it also has four endemic mammals and 10 near endemic mammals. And that's one of the gerbils at the bottom there, which is endemic to Egypt. And so we compared two methods of estimating or predicting patterns of species richness. The first was to generate individual distribution models for each species. So took a set of occurrences for each species, built a distribution model, and then added them together to produce species richness, shown on the top of that diagram there. And the second method was to model species richness patterns directly. So to take data on species richness itself and then produce a prediction of species richness patterns directly from that. So these are the data for Egyptian butterflies and mammals, the sightings, the sites have been recorded, circles for mammals, triangles for butterflies, and the grey areas show Egypt's protected areas, which is something we'll return to later. So just to illustrate the process of making the predictions, this is the distribution models. So this is a set of records for the long-tailed blue butterfly here. The environmental variables we used described climate, and because we had 20 climate variables and they were quite highly correlated with each other, we did a principal components analysis to reduce them into four principal components. And we also used a categorical variable describing habitat. and is the distribution model for the same butterfly species. Again, green and yellow areas show low probability of recurrence, orange and red areas show high probability of recurrence. So, across all species, this graph shows the relative contribution of the environmental variables to the models. And you can see that for the mammals, habitat and the first principal component, which describes mostly maximum temperature and rainfall, were the most important variables. For the butterflies, it was habitat and the second principal component, which described minimum temperature mainly. And so once we generated the models for all the species, we added them together. This is the prediction for butterflies. A similar one was made for mammals. So you can see high areas of predicted high richness around the Nile Delta, the depressions here down the Nile Valley, and in the Sinai Desert, in the Sinai Peninsula. And to compare it with our second method, which I'll describe next, we resampled that prediction to a half degree resolution. The original resolution was at 1 kilometre. Right, so the second method, we calculated species richness values for half degree grid squares, those that have been sampled, and then we modelled those values using a generalised linear model with Poisson errors, using the same variables as before, the four principal component variables describing climate and habitat. So this just shows the results from that. The numbers in the table show the deviance explained by each of the variables separately. And if we just highlight, these are the ones that were important, made the important contributions to the distribution models. And as you can see, for the mammals, the variables that contributed are very similar. For the butterflies, there are a few differences. And this was the prediction of species richness that we made using the generalised linear model, the direct prediction of richness. And so, correlating those to observed species richness, we found that both methods correlated positively with observed species richness. So this shows the correlation for the distribution models, so generating distribution models and summing it. Triangles for mammals, crosses for butterflies. And this is the correlation for the model of species richness values directly. And again, both were positive, although the butterflies is a much weaker correlation than for the mammals. And the two methods agreed very well with each other. So both positively correlated between the two different predictions. Right, so we used our species richness data to try and assess whether Egypt's protected areas represent species diversity well. Egypt has 27 protected areas. They've all been gazetted since 1983, and so there's been some knowledge of diversity patterns used when designating those areas. And in total, they cover 11% of the land area of Egypt. And we found that predicted species richness was significantly higher for both mammals and butterflies inside protected areas than outside. And that observed species richness also was significantly higher inside than outside for both groups. So just to conclude that first section, neither of the methods matched observe species richness perfectly, probably because there are a lot of factors that can determine species distributions that weren't included in the models, including interactions between species, effects of soils, microclimate, and dispersal history of the groups. But the two methods did produce very similar results, and direct models of species richness may be useful if we don't know something about species identity. For example, if we're using species richness estimators, if sampling has been incomplete. And protected areas seem to represent species richness very well. Okay, and so to move on to the second part of the talk, which is what was the bit that was publicised, which is looking at the effects of climate change on species distributions. Climate change has already been shown to be affecting species. Distributions are shifting towards higher latitudes and towards higher altitudes. Spring events are occurring earlier each year, and there have already been observed changes in population dynamics and community composition. And we'll be focusing on the first of those today. So species distribution models can be used to try and predict how distributions will change in the future. So we take what the model tells us about the way that the species responds to the environment in the current time and apply that to predicted future climates to try and predict how distributions will shift with time. And previous studies have estimated large shifts in species distributions and very alarming rates of extinction. So, for example, Berry et al. Modelled 50-odd species in Britain, and they found that some species were predicted to expand their ranges while others were predicted to contract their ranges. So this map at the bottom shows an example for the trailing azalea. On the left is its current distribution. The middle map, shows its predicted distribution in the 2050s under a scenario of moderate climate change. And the map on the right shows its predicted distribution in the 2050s under a more extreme scenario of climate change. And you can see that the predicted contraction is very dramatic. Similarly, Thomas et al. Generated distribution models for several taxonomic groups in regions all over the world. And they predicted that up to a third of all species would be committed to extinction as a result of climate change. And you may remember a few years ago this study made front page headlines in the daily newspapers because of its dramatic predictions. It's difficult to assess the accuracy of models predicting future distributions because the changes that they're trying to predict haven't yet occurred. And one way to get around this problem is to predict changes that are already known to have happened, changes in the past. So we did this for two species from two groups, taxonomic groups in Britain. So we took a 30-year time series of data for British hoverflies and British birds. And we had data on both species occurrence throughout Britain and species abundance from a single site. And those data are shown on these maps here. So the red points in both cases show the occurrence data, and the yellow points show the sites that we had detailed abundance data for the 30 years. That's a garden in Leicestershire in the case of the hoverflies and Treswell Wood in North Nottinghamshire in the case of the birds. Climate data were taken from the UK Climate Information Programme, habitat data from the Institute of Terrestrial Ecology, and agriculture data from the Edina censuses. And all the data, both for the species and for the environment, were divided into 5 or 6 year time periods. So just to illustrate the processes of model building, these are the 6 time periods that we used for the hoverfly species, along the bottom there. So we initially built a model for one time period using species data and environmental data from that time period, and we'll call these initial models. So they're just predicting contemporary distributions. We then built a set of projected models, we call them change models, which assume that the changes in the environment that have happened over the last 30 years have impacted on species distributions. And so we incorporated environmental data from each of the subsequent time periods into those models. And then as a control, we assume that environmental changes had no effect on species distributions, and so we used the initial model unchanged to try and predict distributions in subsequent time periods. We'll call these control models. And we repeated that process for each of the other time periods, projecting models both forwards and backwards. The models were tested both against the nationwide occurrence data, and to do this we used the AUC statistic. Now this is calculated by plotting the proportion of species recorded presences that were correctly predicted as present against the proportion of species absences that were incorrectly predicted as present against the threshold that you use. So the models predict a continuous probability of occurrence, so you apply a set of increasing thresholds, calculate the proportion of presences correctly predicted and the proportion of absences incorrectly predicted, and then that gives you a curve as both increase with decreasing thresholds. And the AUC statistic is the area under the curve. Perfect models have an AUC statistic of 1. Random models have an AUC of 0.5. We also tested the models against the abundance data from the single site. So we related recorded species abundance to the predicted probability of occurrence by the model using a generalised linear model with negative binomial errors. And the fit of those models was assessed using the slope of the relationship and Akiki's information criterion, which is another measure of model fit. So, moving on to the results, at the y-axis here we have model accuracy is measured, this is testing against nationwide occurrence data, model accuracy measured using the AUC statistic, and along the x-axis we have the time period that we were trying to predict, and the different colours of the points show the different time periods from which the data came from. Initial models predicted distributions reasonably well, so they all achieved AUC statistics which were above 0.8, which indicates a pretty good predicted distribution. The change models, those which assumed that environmental changes were affecting species distributions, were much worse. And importantly, the control models, those that assumed that environmental changes were having no effect on species distributions, were all significantly better than the change models, those that assumed that climate changes were impacting distributions. A similar story when we tested against abundance data. So this time along the y-axis we have the slope of the relationship between recorded abundance and model predicted probability across all the species recorded. And again, along the x-axis, we have the time period that we were trying to predict distributions for. So again, looking at the initial models, those predicting contemporary distributions only, the fit between recorded abundance and predicted probability was pretty good. All had significantly positive slopes. The change models, those that assumed that environmental changes were changing distributions, again, were much worse. Many weren't significantly different from zero, and some even had significantly negative slopes. So the change models weren't predicting abundance at the single sites very well. And again, the control models, assuming no effect of climate change on distributions, were much better. The relationship with abundance was much stronger. And so to show that in terms of shifting distributions, we plotted mean latitudes across all species. So that is the mean latitude at which all species are predicted to occur in Britain. So as expected, distributions were predicted to shift northwards over time. However, when we plotted observed mean latitudes, the change wasn't matched. And this line was corrected for possible biases in recording. This data is all for the hoverflies because we only had two time points. For birds, we couldn't do a comparable analysis. So just a few reasons why predictions of future distributions might fail. One is uncertainties in the way that the climate will change in the future. This picture on the right here shows scenarios from the Climate Research Unit at Norwich. So along in the columns we've got three different time periods, 2020s, 2050s and 2080s on the right. And the four rows show different scenarios. So the low scenario at the top, working down to the more extreme scenario at the bottom. And you can see by the 2080s, temperature changes could fall anywhere between 1 degree and over 3 degrees. Now these predictions, of course, are getting better all the time, but still we can't be absolutely certain how climate is going to change in the future. This, of course, wasn't an issue in our models because we were using changes that are known to have already happened in the climate over the last 30 years. Another problem with prediction of future distributions is that species may not be able to track changes in the climate fast enough to keep up. So Svenning et al. In 2008 showed that plant species are still not at equilibrium with climate after the last ice age. And so with changes as rapid as we're dealing with at the moment in the climate, then it's likely that species are going to lag behind changes in the climate. Also, species interact with each other. This is known to be important in determining current distributions. Araujo and Loreto in 2007 showed that the distributions of butterfly, or particularly a butterfly species, the Clouded Apollo, was determined in a large part by the distribution of its host plant. And species interactions aren't yet considered in climate change models generally, but the way that interacting species respond to climate is going to affect the way that other species do. And they may not be able to fully realise changes in the climate, in their potential habitat, if the interacting species aren't there as well. Species may adapt to the new conditions. This could be evolutionary adaptation, although perhaps this is unlikely over the 30 generations that that we were studying. But the responses may also be due to phenotypic plasticity. And earlier this year in Science, there was a paper showing that great tits in Whiteham Woods in Oxfordshire have significantly changed their spring laying dates, their egg laying dates, in response to changing climate in recent years. Finally, we may see changes in population trends before we see changes in overall distributions. And there's some evidence that this is the case for rare birds in Britain, paper in Biology Letters again earlier this year, showing that changes in the climate could be causing changes in population trends. But we found that the model predictions showed a poor relation to abundance, and so that seems perhaps unlikely here, although it's something that's worth investigating further using looking at sites at the edge of species ranges. All of our two abundant sites were in the middle of ranges. So to conclude that section, the models predicted current distributions very well, but they failed to predict distributions as a result of climate change. And this is very important as these techniques are used to make very big conclusions about how species might respond to climate change and receive a lot of attention in the media. And so it's very important that they may not be predicting distributions as well as they seem. So finally, I'd like to thank everyone that's collaborated with both of these projects. Tom Reed and Francis Gilbert have been involved in both of them. Stuart Ball from JNCC, Simon Gillings from BTO, Jenny Owen and Christopher Foe, who are all involved with the Climate Change Project, and Ahmed Agabas and Sami Zalat, who are involved with the butterflies work in Egypt. I'd also like to thank the Behavioural Ecology Group in Biology and Natural Environment Research Council for funding my project. Thank you very much.